legislature and let the record reflect that the time is 3:04 and the date is Wednesday, January 22nd, 2003. Let the record also reflect that even though we don't need one for this meeting, we do have a quorum. Representative Crawford is here, Harry Crawford, David Guttenberg, Representative Norman Rokeberg, Vice Chairman Bob Lynn, and myself, Tom Anderson, Chairman. And I might add that it's nice to see Representative Rokeberg here. We were just talking 8 years on this committee, 4 years as chairman, so I'm honored to have him next to me here as a coach. I would like to also introduce my chief of staff, Josh Appleby, and he is also the committee aide, and his direct line for members, if you want to write this down, is 465-4954, if you have questions or your staff has questions, and Josh will assist, of course, in the administration of the committee and maintaining files and records. The purpose, of course, of our meeting today is to receive an overview from the Department of Labor. But before we begin, again, I'd like to welcome new and returning members. And we do have an important task at hand in terms of the bills we will be hearing. And my goal as chairman is to thoroughly listen to these bills, but also to maintain brevity and efficiency. And a good example is to start on time and to end on time and to, of course, maintain civility and courtesy between members and those talking to us. As you're aware, we have meetings Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and sometimes those may be canceled due to late sessions or departures of members. 3 to 5 is the time.
Oh, Chairman, excuse me. 3 to 5, 3:15.
Pardon me?
3:15.
Is it 3:15?
Oh, when did you discuss the... We have a brief at ease.
Yeah, okay, at ease.
We discussed moving it to 3:15. So
and Representative Rokeberg reminds me that because I am a member of the Judiciary Committee, we will begin at 3:15, and we'll notify you guys that you guys in terms of record and in terms of when we're going to have our meeting on Monday and on Wednesday. And I have a note here. On Wednesday, we will begin hearing the first bills, and on Monday, the commissioner will be before us for his confirmation hearing. So without further ado, I welcome the commissioner designee, Greg O'Clary, to the House Labor and Commerce Committee. And if you could please introduce your staff present before you begin with your overview.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to be in the habit of referring to Mr. Rokeberg as Mr. Chairman, too, because I called him that for 8 years. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Mr. Chairman, actually emeritus.
Well, I'm still a chairman, so it's okay.
This committee, they tell me. The rule's the important one, right? Let me, before we introduce all of our folks, I kind of wanted to congratulate you all. You are some of the freshman class here are not the only people who are new at this. I have been involved with government, outside government, for probably some 40 years, representing workers in the seafaring trades. And appeared before committees. I've been a student of the legislative process, and I have the greatest respect for you all that put your names on ballots and go through all of this pain to get to Juneau. Welcome to Juneau. I know you had a lot of pain. Anyway, first up, and we will be as brief as possible, Mr. Chairman, because we would like you to be able to ask questions of us. And remember, we are very new on the job. We've been here, Brother Fisher and I have been here 45 days and counting. And I want to have my deputy, Ed Fisher, join me at the table because one of the things that we've done with the department is that we intend to reflect our view and the governor's view of what the Department of Labor and Workforce Development should be under his guidance. It should truly be a labor and management partnership that includes all workers, that includes all businesses, because our approach, if we're going to have any effect on a positive, in a positive way on the economy, in order for us to put unemployed workers and retrained workers into jobs, we need employers, we need business. So Mr. Fisher's background and his bio will show you that he is truly a management person. And I'm from organized labor, and we have formed a true partnership here from the beginning. So with that, there is one of our directors, by the way, at the moment, that is not present, and I'll get into that as soon as I introduce our folks. Many of you know Mr. Grossi with the Workman's Compensation Division because he's appeared before you, and I'm told he is Norm Roquefort's best friend.
He's a regular in this room.
You didn't get the answer you're looking for. Next to Mr. Grossi is Ted Burke, who has been with the Employment Security Department for many years, is the acting director of that division at this point. And we have Hallie Denton on his right, who is the acting director of
Labor Standards and Safety,
the occupational health and safety folks for you all. And to her immediate right is this, would you please stand, sir?
I always do what he asks.
Mr. Quisenberry and Ms. Dahlstrom can probably walk together, and I don't know who's tallest, but I would expect my guy is. But anyway.
Let's see.
Mr. Quisenberry is the acting director of the Division of
Vocational
Rehabilitation. And, you know, I'll get all these names right now.
Right,
you, Joellen Hanrahan, is our acting director of
administrative services,
and she was prior to that our internal auditor in the office. Can I leave anybody out?
Oh,
just you. We have a veteran of the Great Wars in the legislative halls that works for us, and it's Paula Scavera on my immediate right. When I worked as a paid staff person for your old colleague, Senator Bill Ray, Representative Roquefort, kind of slapped this out of my face, she and I crawled the halls together. She got paid. I was a dollar a year consultant, and Bill Ray still owes me $9. So Ms. Scavera has worked, as you know, a long time for the legislative process. She worked for Ledge Affairs, I think, for about 12 years.
Ledge Research, right, for 12 years.
And drafting...
doing research.
Confidential bills and doing research. And you've seen her around the halls, and I'm sure you've seen her in the building. And we're pleased to have her services to assist us in assisting you, not only get to know us, but in our good offices working with yours to make government work for the people we are here to serve, citizens of the state. The handout that we gave you has got somewhat of an overview. It tells you where we are in terms of the size of the budget. These pie charts always make me kind of cringe because I've never actually cut a piece of pie this thin before, but you'll see in the starting with the first page. Let me go to the mission first. We're not sure that the mission that was handed us, that was the mission of the department, which indicated that we're responsible to, quote, foster and promote the welfare of the wage earners of the state, improve their working conditions, and advance their opportunities for profitable employment. We're not sure that that mission fits totally in today's world because in 1998, the federal government passed an act called the Workforce Investment Act. And as a result of that act, the state legislature adopted House Bill 40 in 1999 that actually took several functions that were housed in the Department of Committee and Regional Affairs, and they gave them to the Department of Labor. And many of those were training programs and other responsibilities that were housed in that particular department. Some of the other duties were sent over to the Commerce Department, and of course that's been renamed now too. As a result of that, the Department of Labor actually grew in size and certainly in responsibility, and then the words workforce development were added to the name of the department. I think the workforce development, and it certainly puzzled me being outside government when I first saw the addition. I had no idea why they did that, and Brother Fisher and I have learned why they did that, and it was a federal initiative to try to streamline and make delivery of training monies and services to the states and to the citizens of America, those federal dollars that flow to training programs to go through a clearinghouse as such. It was the initial, I think, attempt to standardize how we spend federal dollars and how we invest them in workforce. Now, there are several challenges that that American businesses and the American people are facing dealing with workforce. That is, we're looking at a workforce replacement problem that industry has probably known about more than we in the public sector have known about it for some time, in that a lot of their trained workforce are retiring or leaving the industry. Within the next 5 years, almost 30% of the folks will be leaving those regular jobs. Now, in the state government, you have had workforce replacement problems in that you did a series of things. The legislature did enacted some early and out legislation that got people to retire early. In House Bill 40, you did some other things to give government tools to bring folks back at less cost to your general fund budget. But the Workforce Investment Act gave us the opportunity to spend dollars wisely with the idea that the private sector would be the lead advisors for how we spend those dollars, and that the idea that we spend dollars to train folks for jobs, not only existing jobs, but for placement in new jobs at good pay. And that's the whole theme of the Workforce Investment Act. Now, when we, Fish and I were handed the responsibility to manage this rather large department, at least larger than it used to be, we learned early on that we needed to find out what this Workforce Investment Act was all about. And so, with the help of a lot of the folks that are seated behind me that were here when we came on scene, we have decided to do some reorganization. And the other director that's not here today is a person that's still being paid by one of our friends in the petroleum producing industry, British Petroleum. And her name is Catherine. Many of you know her as Kitty Farnham. Catherine Farnham has been active on with the Producers Consortia. She is the inside trainer and career ladder person for British Petroleum. She's very capable, and we were able to convince her to serve the citizens of the state in the new division as director. And we'll put all of the workforce development tools in her shop as the director of the Division of Business Partnerships. You see, I am really the Charlie McCarthy. He really knows all more about this department than I do because he reads more. He and I come to work between 5:30 and 6 o'clock every morning, and usually we're still there at 7 at night. And we do that because our chief of staff is so used to dealing with the East Coast that he automatically wakes up at 4 o'clock and grabs a phone. So when he grabs a phone and nobody's answering in D.C., he calls us, and we are there to answer the phone. You dressed up today.
Every day. The chair will recognize Representative Gatto was here.
Representative and I met each other the other night down at the hangar. He was in disguise, incognito, he said. Let me do this. Ed, you might want to say a few words about the direction we're taking with the department.
Actually, you put it quite well. I'm thank you for the opportunity to appear, and we're pleased to have this chance to introduce ourselves and to get to know you and get to introduce our capable people behind us. Both of us being the newest people in the department, we're relying heavily on the experience that is represented back here. We feel very strongly that the governor of the state of Alaska has made it clear that he is focused on economic development, and our objective is to try to create a climate in which economic development is a reality in the state of Alaska, and that the employment opportunities are brought to the state of Alaska by people who are willing to make an investment in the state. And therefore, it's our obligation to the governor and to the people of Alaska to try to create the climate that makes Alaska an attractive place for investment. The reason for forming the division called the Division of Business Partnerships is to try to form a policymaking arm of the department that incorporates the business managers, the business people in the state of Alaska in the policymaking aspect of workforce development. What does the employer want in the way of workforce development? What kind of training do they want? What kind of people do they want? When do they want them? How soon? Can we create opportunities for training that anticipates what the business sector will need down the road, a year, 2 years, 3 years, and can we create those skills out of the people that are presently in Alaska trying to find jobs for Alaskan citizens. We are committed to advancing the agenda that the governor has put forth in terms of economic development, resource development, and transportation improvements, and it's our job to make that happen from the standpoint of the Department of Labor. We're happy to have that opportunity.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, continue, and these folks have promised to be very brief because I know you have some questions that you want to ask us. Joellen, do you want to just give them a brief rundown on what you do for us?
Sure.
Let me move out. You can take this chair, and I'll
switch chairs here.
Sure.
Good afternoon. I'm Joellen Hanrahan. I'm the Acting Director of Administrative Services, and as with all Department Administrative Services, we take care of supporting the rest of the department and the missions of the rest of the department. We're comprised of three functions, although we have a lot of functions within that. We have our Management Services section, which does our budget, accounting, personnel, or human resources, I guess is the new word for personnel. We also handle the publications in the department, which many of you may have seen. Our Trends magazine comes out from the Administrative Services section. I also have oversight of the data processing group with the department, which is a rather large data processing group because we have very large applications with the unemployment insurance program and employment services. We have both mainframe and distributed systems. We also have the labor market information group, which provides information to multiple customers, both state, federal, government, employers, and other states also as well. They collect and analyze and publish information on unemployment, employment, wage rates, occupational injuries, population estimates and forecasts, and other economic and demographic data. They also provide a lot of information for legislators during the session when they're putting bills through and need information on the economics within the state or population within the state. We have a few issues that are outlined for the next year, and one of the top issues that starts off with is our data processing. Since the world now revolves around data processing, that becomes a more important issue for us, and as technology is changing, it becomes even more important. So we have a few issues related to that, and that's recruitment and retention of data processing personnel, and I believe that's an issue across the state because Alaska is not a hotbed of technology for computers, but we're growing that way. And we're trying to work with the limited availability and the competition within the state for the state systems. And we have started a training program within in-house to train people right on through to levels of expertise. One other issue with our data processing is transitioning to new technology as the state is looking at moving from the mainframe, and also as we electronic filing and payments are becoming more every day. We need to, as a state, move in that direction, particularly for our primary customers, the employers and the workers of Alaska. We also, another issue that we have related to data processing is we're impacted by federal mandates. This past year, the temporary extended unemployment compensation passed, which required changes within our processes, procedures, and our information systems within a very short time frame. We have a few of those mandates looming over us that may also cause issues. When that happens, we have to delay or defer development and maintenance on the areas that we should be going, which is transitioning to new technology and developing ease of access for our customers. The Labor Market Information Organization has a few issues arising. One is that the funding for that from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics has remained flat, although the required modeling has become more complex that they are required to do, and we have had a significant in terms of statistical, because I'm not a statistical person, but we've had a steady and somewhat large growth of work sites in the state over the last few years. So that increases their workload significantly, and they are on flat funding. They provide a lot of the demographic and census information to the state. An issue with that will be that they are that is a general funded function, and as that funding mixes changes, that information may become more vulnerable because they're not getting the general funds. They're going to be required to get the funds from outside entities, other agencies, to replace those funds in order to provide the demographic and census information. Currently, there are already some agencies helping to pay for that. They do provide demographic and census information for things such as the state revenue sharing, allocation of state revenue sharing. So it's widely used information. I know when we think of census, we think of every 10 years, but there is census information that is being used annually. And I think that's probably about describes us. Do you have any questions?
You already 10 minutes ago. Now we're going to kind of move everybody through, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman, then we go back to questions unless you cover that one for you.
I'm Paul Grassi. I'm the Director of Workers' Compensation. I'll try to really make this 3 minutes. The Workers' Compensation Division is basically three components. It's the Workers' Compensation Agency, the Fisherman's Fund, and the Second Injury Fund. Workers' Compensation in Alaska is basically a privatized system. You purchase an insurance company. If you're big enough, you become self-insured, or if you're a public entity, you can join a JIA, joint insurance arrangement. So basically all the division does for 90% of the cases is track all the injuries and make sure that the claims are getting paid and the reporting is being done and the various things like that. However, if there's a dispute that arises, there's a couple other instances, but if a dispute arises, then we get involved by accepting pleadings and basically holding pre-hearings, try to settle the cases. If not, we can go to a formal hearing process and settle cases through compromises and releases, write formal decisions. some of the other aspects of workers' comp that we do is we run a reemployment retraining system. We determine whether someone is incapable of returning to their work or at the time of injury. If not, they may be eligible for a retraining benefit, and we determine eligibility, we determine viability of a plan, retraining plan, and we also make determinations on cooperation, or the employee's cooperation of that process. We also administer the self-insurance agency for big enough employers. They can become self-insured if, under certain conditions, and we administer that program. We also investigate uninsured employers, and operate a program for that function. The Second Injury Fund is a fund that reimburses employers for claimants that are involved in a second injury and are involved in a long-term disability, if under certain conditions, if the employer applies, they'll be reimbursed for those benefits. The pooling concept for that. The other aspect is the Fisherman's Fund. Fisherman's Fund is paid for out of commercial fishermen's licenses, and we pay for emergency medical treatment for those. And that's basically the nutshell for workers' comp. There's a few more details. Thank you very much.
Ted is with the Employment Security Division, and he is being impacted the most by the reorganization because we're taking some of the folks out of his shop to assist in his farmer's shop, but we haven't told him how many yet. So, Ted?
So I'll speak to it all.
What's left?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Ted Burke, and I'm the Acting Director for the Employment Security Division. And in this division, currently we operate 22 job centers in 18 communities. We're staffing from the Job Training Partnership people and the employment services people in each of those job centers. We also have unemployment insurance, telephone direct line connects to the call centers in each of those job centers as well. The division is made up of three components. The unemployment insurance section. That section has and operates three call centers. We also operate in employee tax units, fraud investigation units, quality control teams, an appeals tribunal unit, and benefit payment control unit. Under the job training and work readiness section, we have a lot to do with the Workforce Investment Act, and under those, we operate and administer grants under dislocated worker programs, youth grants, adult grants. We work with the Denali Commission on training grants, the STEP program, state training and employment program, adult basic education programs, and employment vocational counseling. We have staff in many of the jobs. Under the employment services program, we administer the basic labor exchange programs in all of the job centers. We have, that comes under Wagner Pizer. We have trade adjustment assistance, which many of you have come in contact with as a result of the fisheries disaster and many of the timber shutdowns in the oil pipeline industry. Veterans grants, the disabled veterans outreach program and representatives and the local veterans employment representatives. We have a workers' opportunity tax program that we administer. We also run the foreign labor certification program for employers throughout the state. We work on a worker profiling reemployment system that is funded by the UI unemployment insurance program, and we have a reemployment services grant. That's about it for what the things I do in my division.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Hallie Denton. I'm the Acting Director of Labor Standards and Safety. Labor Standards and Safety comprises a number of disparate functions within the department. Our main program is, our largest program is Occupational Safety and Health. Alaska is a so-called state plan state, meaning that we have local oversight of federal occupational safety and health regulations. Employers deal with us rather than having to deal with the federal OSHA program, which we think is a benefit to the employers. Within OSHA, we have enforcement responsibilities for those federal regulations. We also offer consultation and training services to employers throughout the state to help them avoid workplace hazards and avoid running afoul of our enforcement arm. We also, within the OSHA program, issue certificates of fitness for people who handle various hazardous substances, asbestos, hazardous paints, which is basically any paint other than latex-based, and explosives, which is a security issue. It means that people who have not been trained and certified by us cannot just walk in somewhere and buy TNT or black powder or whatever, which is a good thing. We also have the, within the division, we have the wage and hour program. Wage and hour has the responsibility for rectifying situations where employees have been underpaid or where pay or benefits has been withheld. Most of these are settled out of court or they're a small claims issue, but for most of the people who are in this situation, the state is an important middleman in that process. They don't have the know-how to go to court or to deal in a any sort of legal way with the employer. We also have responsibilities under Title 36 of the Alaska Statutes, which is the public contracts, to ensure that people bidding on state-funded contracts, public-funded contracts, are paying the prevailing wage. And this provides a level playing field for the scrupulous employer who plans to pay prevailing wage rather than import people or underpay. I mean, people can bid fairly. It actually provides a benefit for the honest employer. We also do child labor permitting for minor employment, and we travel throughout the state making visits to work sites and ensuring that children are not put in hazardous situations or doing inappropriate sorts of employment. We also have the mechanical inspection section, which does boiler and pressure vessel, which is pressurized tanks of various sorts, inspections. We also inspect and certify elevators, escalators, ski lifts, tramways, amusement rides, any sort of mechanical lifting device, as it were, public ones, just to make sure that they are functioning and don't pose a hazard. Mechanical inspection also has a couple of functions in support of other departments. We, when people apply for a license, well, I should back up. We do contractor licensing for contractors, electrical administrators, mechanical administrators, when people, and we also do certificates of fitness for electricians and plumbers, and when people apply for a license in any of those areas, we check to make sure that they're not in arrears on their child support payments. And we do help the Department of Community and Economic Development with contractor licensing and make sure that contractors working on jobs are licensed under their statutes, under community and economic development statutes. And the last program that we have is the Alaska Safety Advisory Council, which is charged with the mission of reducing accidental death and injuries within the state. They put on a yearly conference, the Governor's Safety Conference, which is held in Anchorage once a year and widely attended by safety professionals. That is operated by a board appointed by the governor. We provide one person to do clerical support for that, and we assist with putting on the conference. And I think that covers us. Thank you.
Well, and you said you certify people that do heavy lifting. I want you to check out Brother Rokeberg and see if he's certified to do heavy lifting as a wheelchair.
No, just the devices.
Devices, okay. Mr. Quisenberry.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Dave Quisenberry. I'm the acting director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. While I've only been the acting director for a few weeks now, I do have experience in vocational rehabilitation coming from the client services component that's there in front of you. In the brief amount of time that I have, I just wanted to give you a snapshot of vocational rehabilitation. Vocational rehabilitation is the oldest employment and social service program in the country, having been created in 1918 for the Soldiers Rehabilitation Act when veterans were injured during World War I. Due to the success of that program, states were provided allotments in 1920 through the Civilian Rehabilitation Act. Alaska, we've had an Office of Vocational Rehabilitation in Alaska since, I tried to go back and do some homework on this, I found in 1947 we had a state plan for vocational rehabilitation in Alaska. The mission of vocational rehabilitation is fairly clear. It's to assist people with disabilities in returning to work and to live independently. We also work with people to help them retain their employment or to regain employment if they've lost their employment as a result of their disability. People with disabilities have the highest incidence of unemployment of any special population. Harris poll in the 90s showed that 2 of 3 people with disabilities were unemployed, and the recent census estimated about 70% of people with disabilities were unemployed. We manage the division by a series of principles. A couple of those I think that are important to us is respect, that people with disabilities need to be treated with dignity and respect. And this is something that we embody in our program. Another significant principle is that we believe that people with disabilities can work. And that's, you know, something that is we don't take lightly at all. Not everyone can work, but we believe that most people with disabilities with proper support and services are able to be employed. We try to maintain a high level of customer service in our organization and achieve a high level of professionalism. A unique part of our program is that people with disabilities must have a significant role in the management of our programs. We have two governor-appointed committees, one the State Independent Living Council and the other is the Governor's Committee on Employment and Rehabilitation with People with Disabilities, and they must have a meaningful role in the policies and management of our organization. We have 8 components to the division. The client services component is the largest. We serve about 4,200 people a year, and the mission of that component is to, on an individual basis, assist people with disabilities in returning to work. Many services are provided through this component, such as training, what we call restoration or medical assistance, transportation. We buy shoes for people. We buy clothes for people so that they can go to work if their particular job requires that type of service. The laws that impact vocational rehabilitation and people with disabilities have changed a great deal over the years, so that entry-level work is not really our goal for people with disabilities. Careers is the goal for people with disabilities, so that they can achieve the same kind of careers and expectations that we have, that they can have the ability to have a career, have a mortgage, own a car, send their children to college, and be in the same kind of debt that most of us are in. So it's to integrate people with disabilities into life. It's a cost-beneficial program. Many people that come to us are on public assistance or Social Security, and our goal is that when they leave the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, that they're tax-paying citizens and employed in their community. The other component is, there are 8 of them, but I'll just hit on a couple of them here. Independent living is a significant component in our organization, and this is a unique aspect of the Law of Vocational Rehabilitation, the Rehabilitation Act, and it basically says that people with very significant disabilities, and that's who serve through this component, should live independently in their communities and not be in institutions if they don't need to be. And with proper supports and services, they can live independently with those supports and services and not incur the high costs of living in an institution or inappropriateness of them having to be in an institution. A teenage person living in an institution that could live independently with supports is what independent living is about. It's a self-advocacy, peer support organization. Grants are provided to independent living centers throughout the state, and those independent living centers are primarily staffed by people with substantial disabilities themselves. So it's the peer support, guidance, and advocacy to assist folks so that they can live independently. We have a disability determination service that's a federally funded operation under the Social Security Act, and they provide adjudication and claims so that when a person applies for Social Security, as a result of a disability, they're the ones that determine whether they have a disability or not. We have a training grant and a special project component, assistive technology, Americans with Disabilities Act. They're in your packet. All of those are components of the division. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I have to tell you how proud Brother Fisher and I are of this team. The reason they are holding the titles acting, we have not received authority yet from the Chief of Staff to fill these on a permanent basis, and those folks are trying out the jobs. Most of them are doing a lot of this work in the departments before they were named to those positions. But we're proud of this team. We think we're moving along the right track. We have some ideas to share with you if you care to hear them about our further reorganization that we're looking at. And we'd be glad to answer any questions that any of the members or you, Mr. Chairman, may have.
I was going to ask Commissioner, do you think we should do it by division, or do you think we should just pop shot it?
Whoever you want to shoot it.
Why don't you go ahead, Representative Gatto?
You mentioned child labor permitting. I'm not sure. Is this for children below a certain age, but not below another certain age, or how far down do we go?
It's for children over the age of 14. Basically, the permit functions as a proof of age. There are certain sorts of employment that are considered appropriate for children between the ages of, I think it's 14 and 17, but I can get back to you on that.
Give me an example of one. It'd be a stocker in a grocery store, or
that kind of thing, working at McDonald's.
Bird picker in the valley.
Can't work past 9 o'clock.
Folks, I'm told that the microphone is far back, so if you could speak up. I know it's difficult, but you don't have to come up, but speak up.
Okay. It would be things like working at McDonald's or, and there are time constraints as well that I can't think of right off the top of my head. They can't work in establishments where alcohol is served, that kind of thing.
Industrial.
Hazardous areas.
Yeah, they shouldn't, we try to keep them out of harm's way.
Before we go to Representative Crawford, do you
I'd like to follow up on that line. This committee passed a bill last year to help expedite the hiring of youth employment. And I'd like to, I'm not sure you can respond today about how that's worked out. It's just 12, we did that last year to help expedite and cut down the paperwork on that. Do you have any idea about how that legislation worked out or any feelings on that?
I would want to get back to you on that. I think that the regulations are still in process, but I will be happy to inform your office about that.
Which was the genesis of this legislation came out of the MATSU, where Mr. Vibelis, is it? The carrot farmer.
The
Vilvis, right. Had some difficulties. That was the genesis. It was Representative Ogun's bill at the time, and it was, I think, a great piece of legislation we worked with the department on to help expedite the signing of forms of parental consent. And we had to, we cut down the mass of paperwork that went on. I'm just very anxious to hear. I guess I'm a little disturbed to hear if they're still writing regulations and we're not doing it right. I just would like to get some feedback later on about it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roker, we will, sir, get back to you immediately on that information, and if the regulations are still being written, we will expedite those on the street and get moving on that. I know you put a lot of time and effort in that bill, both you and Representative Crawford.
I heard something a moment ago that, sounded kind of disturbing to me. It sounded like there was going to be a large focus on workforce development, but you know, part of what the Labor Department is about is providing those services that that we have for years. You know, making sure that people get paid what they're supposed to get paid, and that they work in a safe industry, and that you know, things like Title 36 that have been put in place. To protect the workers, that they're enforced. So if we're moving people over to workforce development, we're going to have the same number of people at the end of the day doing the job, but more are going to be in workforce development. Then I'm not sure that these things are going to get done in the way that they should be done. I've been very concerned over the last few years that as people retired in the department, that we weren't bringing on new people. You know, the fewer and fewer people that are enforcing wage and hour and Title 36 and OSHA. We used to see people on the job that they would come out and actually do courtesy inspections ahead of time to try to head off accidents. Now the only time we ever see somebody from OSHA, it seems, is after we've had an accident. And usually it has to be a serious accident. I mean, we just don't have the people doing the job that we once did. And I'm concerned that the reorganization that you've mentioned so far really isn't talking about doing the things that we felt like the Labor Department should be doing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crawford, first of all, let me apologize for leaving you with the impression that all we're going to be doing is workforce development. What I meant to say was that this commissioner will devote a good part of his time for the first year or so getting the workforce development side working and up to speed and to be in compliance with the Workforce Investment Act of 1998 and House Bill 40 that you all passed. The reason why Ed Fisher is with us today and is my partner in managing the department is because that he has spent and is paying particular attention to the areas that you're concerned about. That we have heard the message loud and clear. I mean, we certainly aren't going to vacate the traditional mission of the Department of Labor to go just into workforce development because we are a combined department. So, Ed, you may want to add your comments to that. I think that, and I understand Representative Crawford's background is in the construction trades as an iron worker, and I think he's seen, and I have seen it too, the as budget cuts came down, there were less inspectors on the job, and you can kind of address how we're going to handle it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crawford, specifically with regard to the consulting function of the Occupational Safety and Health Group, there are 10 consultants on staff, and they function strictly by invitation. They don't make a courtesy call, as you described. They're not allowed to do that. If you want a consulting inspection as an employer, you call us. We send an inspector to you. The compliance folks are not allowed by law to announce their arrival on the job site. They are strictly unannounced and uninvited, and we have a like number of compliance officers, mainly based in Anchorage. There's one in Ketchikan. I think there's one here, and the rest are in Anchorage and Fairbanks. And I cannot tell you at this moment, sir, whether those numbers have decreased over the recent time, but we can certainly get back to you with some numbers on what they have been in the past and what they are today.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, did you have a follow-up, sir?
Well, I just wanted to mention that, you know, maybe the numbers might be the same or even a little bit less, but you know, the number of people that we have working, the number of jobs and all have increased over the years, and I'm just talking about personal experience. We don't see the folks out there as we once did, and I believe that our jobs aren't as safe as they once were. I really believe that over the last few years, and I mean, not just dealing with the folks in Title 36, you know, they don't have it near as many people doing that job today as they once did. As people retire or get transferred to other areas or quit, they haven't been filling those jobs. There are a lot of unfilled positions in the Labor Department, and I think that the Labor Department's done a really fine job of trying to protect our workforce, but I believe that there's, you know, we in the legislature haven't really done our job to make sure that they're funded in the way that they should be.
Mr. Chairman, I need to report to you one of the things that Mr. Fisher and I did within the 24 hours of appearing on scene. That Mr. Fisher was inspecting a first aid kit there, and he found it was not in compliance with our OSHA standards. Therefore, we ordered an immediate inspection of all the Department of Labor facilities because, first we asked when was the last time that we inspected our own facilities, and it had been some time. So we adopted the idea that in the premise that if we were going to require employers and contractors and those that we enforce the laws on to comply with the laws that were made to protect workers, then we should be leading that charge. And you may want to just briefly tell them what we found.
We have found that the Department of Labor is in need of remedial action with regard to its compliance with its own rules. And we are actually using our own consulting service to inspect the facilities and to help us bring our operations and our facilities into compliance with our own rules.
Thank you. Before Representative Gatto, any other members, new members, do you have questions? No?
Oh, go ahead.
Representative Gatto?
Representative Crawford raised the question of keeping up to speed. I'm just curious about your track record. If we go back several years and we know there's possibly been an increase in the number of employees that are involved, and then hopefully you've kept up with the number of visits, but is there some way to evaluate whether we're safer now or less safe than we used to be? By numbers, not by feelings, but actually to say, you know, we've reported 400 minor injuries, 100 major injuries, and now, this year, it's proportionally less or more. Do we know?
Maybe our whole team can jump in there anywhere, folks, if you've got the information that could help.
I'm Paul Grassi. I'm the Director of Workers' Compensation.
Sit or stand?
Stand's fine.
I hurt your back, Paul.
That's my job, watching.
Representative Gatto, the chair. Actually, the injury rates have gone down in Alaska. They are they have gone down per 100 employees, and so in fact they have not greatly, but definitely down.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, we've had two very serious accidents in the oil patch within the last few months. And the, while I can't discuss specifics because there are certainly some issues there, we're very concerned about worker safety. It's one of the things that we do. It's our responsibility. It's all of our responsibility with respect to worker safety. We can give you the data that we have generated, so you have hard data. Representative Gatto? Gatto, and I'll get that right.
And I'll tell
New York,
you
right? You will. We will give you the information we have because our research and analysis section runs numbers on just about everything you can imagine. So we will get back with him on that information. Did you have something you wanted to add?
No, I'm just basically going to say the same thing possible.
Then I'll ask a question, Mr. Grassi. In terms of you're talking about workers' compensation and the hearing process, how many hearing officers are there in the state? Approximately?
There are five in Anchorage, one in Juneau. One in Fairbanks.
And are they attorneys or just trained?
Right now they're all attorneys. We've had non-attorneys in the past.
Follow-up, Representative, real quick?
I have a question for Mr. Grassi.
Okay, I'm done. Go ahead.
Mr. Grassi, I believe it was 3 years ago or how long ago was it that this body allowed the provided legislation, which I believe I sponsored, to increase the compensation or payments for worker compensation payments? How long ago was that now?
Representative Roper, through the chair, that was in, it actually went into effect July 1 of 2000.
Okay.
And we did raise benefits significantly, I believe, for the state of, for the injured workers. They hadn't at the time, and Representative Roekberg led the charge on this, I think, ultimately. They hadn't been raised for, I believe it was at that time, 12 years. And so they, the legislature found, did get together, and we came up with some formulas and various other things, and we raised benefits pretty much across the board.
One thing we discovered there when we did that, we did make a mistake because we were thinking in terms of the fiscal year, and we implemented the increase on July 1, which was an error because we should have been more sensitive to the private sector and their contractual obligations and seasonality of work here in the state, and it probably should have been on a calendar year basis. But it had to do with the way the statute was written and the look-back provisions, and it was. But anyway, I think I want to make sure you make a note to the commissioner about implementation of any kind of changes there that could affect the private sector and in terms of the business cycle in Alaska, and vis-a-vis our mindset as from the government side. Sometimes there's an unintended consequence that we don't quite get figured out because we did make a mistake there, I think. But the real question is, because of that increase, what has happened in the insurance underwriting market since as a consequence? Have we lost more underwriters, or are we even, and how are premiums holding up?
Representative Roekberg, through the chair, because of that, those increases, we just, and I think we, at the time we calculated the increase, I want to say it was a 7.8% increase in premium. 7.9% average increase of premium, and that went into effect. Since that time, there's been a whole lot of other factors that have affected premium, and one of which is the market itself. Of insurance makes a lot of their money off of investing their money, and they pay benefits over time or pay claims over time. That's one of the problems. Health, the increase in health costs keep going up at a much larger rate than the rest of the economy. That's another factor, and just the fact that it's become a hard money market. There's fewer insurance carriers in the state, and that's the market force that's affecting some of this as well.
Like, and there was some follow-up in that. I mean, follow-up, there was some offsetting factors in time to expedite or streamline the process, which was endeavored to balance the ad hoc committee's recommendation to the state and so forth. That's when they set up a plan or qualify. Does any of that work any?
Representative Rookberg, through the chair, are you talking about the fees? I'm not really.
No, some of the we tried to streamline some of the process to cut down some of the process cost of the litigation and hearing stuff. And
well, we're still working on some of that, Representative Rookberg, through the chair. One of the problems we're having is delays in the cases. Just a hearing time lag, and that's one of the issues that we're dealing with right now, and it's part of the missions and measures for the division.
We're talking about this, but we'd like to talk to you about that in a later date, not take up too much time today.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to, Representative Rooker, I'd be happy to set up a direct appointment with your staff to go into this in depth, if you like, sir.
Good luck.
Senator Guttenberg, Gatto.
Mr. Chairman, a few years ago, the legislature implemented House Bill 40, and over the past at least three legislative sessions, the legislature has been working on missions and measures, a way for the legislature and the public to see the value of departments and how things are being delivered to the public. And it's a quantitative way to be able to judge those things, find improvements where they need to be improved. You're reorganizing the department. In what way are you going to reorganize the department where there's going to be inconsistent with the past values and judgments of what's happening? So in some way where there's not just a break in how things have been judged and valued and evaluated. Now we're going to go into something else and we're going to say, well, there's been a reorganization. We don't have numbers that show that's consistent with how we deliver services now. Are you going to be able to deliver a consistent number for services and how people are getting services delivered to them, whether it's the number of people waiting in line or it's how job searches are being conducted and how fast that's happening, or workers' comp being delivered, or any number of other things?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg. Mm-hmm. I got that right, finally. Representative Guttenberg, the question you asked has several answers, and I don't have all those answers today because I don't really have the total vision as to where we're going to be in total reorganization now. But let me assure you that our department, as all departments, are following the missions and measures statements that were given. You will probably, and this will come up during budget time when we talk with the Finance Committee, about any new initiatives we do within the department, we'll set up the missions and measures standard for that particular component. But it's our philosophical view, both the deputy and myself, is that we're going to try to make, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings in the room, but we are going to try to make the Department of Labor the most efficient government business operated within the state government. That means that we will demand more in terms of accountability for our expenditures and the grants we put out. We will seek to provide jobs at the end of every training course that we fund, and we will try to deliver us the services that we are responsible for to the public, that is the workers and the citizens of the state, in the most efficient manner possible. And that's all I can tell you at this point. Anything to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, the reorganization as it's presently contemplated is not likely to have any effect, any measurable effect on the one-stop, the job centers. Those functions will continue to be staffed as they are at present. The delivery of services to the client should be unaffected. What we are focusing on with this reorganization is to attempt to bring the employer to the table as well, and that the new division is focused and aimed at getting more employer involvement in the workforce development aspect of what we do, the training parts, the things that, and that's from a policy point of view, I might add. They're not in the delivery side of it, but the people that are in the one-stop centers are going to have a seat on the policy-making board in some
way or other, and we're not sure about how that's going to work just yet, because there are some statutory requirements for us to fulfill in filling those boards. But our plan, at least, calls for the regional managers of the one-stop centers to have a policy-making role, so that when the policy is made, they have an ownership interest in it because they helped formulate it. They carry that to the one-stop centers, and the policy is delivered to the one-stop centers and acted on at that level. The actual staffing that you're concerned about and how many people would wait in line, right now I don't have a feel for how many people wait in line. I've been to Ketchikan in my hometown, and I've observed what goes on there, and I can tell you I didn't see anybody waiting in line. I saw people being served. There were several computers in a room, 8 or 10 computers in a room. There was nobody standing outside the door waiting to sit at a computer. They were being moved through as quickly as they could, and I don't anticipate that you're going to notice any change in the level of service being delivered.
Representative Crawford, did you have a follow-up or just another question?
Another question.
Okay, then Representative Gatto, then Lynn, then Roper.
Work comp question for Mr. Grassi. I guess three questions. The number of claims typically going up or down?
You're going to be here a while, I can tell that. Have a seat, Paul.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, the number of actual injuries that are occurring is basically staying even over the years. But that actually means it's lowering, because the number of workers is increasing. So it stayed relatively even as far as the number. It's somewhere between, oh, I'm going to say 26,000 and 30,000 a year.
Okay. And the number of cases that are controverted relative to the number you receive, going up or down?
The number of controverted cases, I think the last time I checked, the percentage of cases that are being controverted, Representative Gatto, through the chair, is actually about 10% of the entire number of injuries. And so that is actually going down, because when I first checked, it was right at about 15%. That was 8 years ago, so it has gone down some.
Well, I worked in a fairly dangerous profession, and it seemed like the number of controverted cases was nearing 100%. It was hard to find somebody, short of having fallen off a building, that didn't have a controversy, but that's just an impression that I wanted to pass upon you. Lastly, if an employee is receiving workman's comp and is now qualified to return to work and returns to work, but still requires additional treatment, you pay that, as far as I understand. You continue to allow him to be paid for treatment. But, and this is where the question is, if indeed he has to leave work to be treated, and his employer doesn't release him for that, is that something you pay? Do you intervene on his behalf? What is the employee's option if indeed he's okay to go back to work according to work comp, but he still needs more treatment, but now that treatment is costing him money because he has to take personal time off? Are these facts reasonable or correct?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that's probably likely to be the case. That's the fact. Is it fair? I guess it's up to this body to determine. If there's not enough, in other words, if they're still getting paid their basic wages, then they wouldn't be entitled to temporary total disability. Also, once they've reached the claim has reached medical stability, it's called, they're not entitled to temporary total disability or time loss benefits. So that is the statute as it exists.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn?
I was amused to hear one of you state that folks with disabilities need debts like the rest of us, and I thought that debt was a disability, at least it is in my case. But also, one of you mentioned independent living facility, and I'm just curious, how many independent living facilities do we have now throughout the state? Where are they located geographically, and what do you think the optimum number of those independent living facilities would be today?
And state your name, please, and the title for our secretary. Thanks.
It's Dave Quisenberry, representative, and Mr. Chairman. We have five central independent living centers. They're in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai. Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai.
Palmer?
No, there are some outlying stations. Some of the independent living centers have smaller out stations in Sitka, in Palmer, in Mat-Su. I wasn't nervous. I could have that right off the top of my head, sir.
Thought we had something in Bethel.
Thank you. We do have a small office in Kotzebue. Thank you, sir. The optimum number, the state plan for independent living, Mr. Representative, calls for a study of Western Alaska with an attempt to try to expand to a outstation independent living center in Bethel. They haven't decided where. They're working on that study now. So optimum, your last part of your question is what would be an optimum amount? Every place there's a person with a very severe disability, they need access to someone that has gone through that process before. You know, someone that is a peer, someone that has lived through that kind of experience before. The independent living philosophy is that that person is in the best position to offer them assistance to live independently, to learn how to manage a personal care assistant, or to interface with the myriad laws and benefits and disincentives and incentives that are available to someone with a disability. The former conversation on workers' compensation is one of those, and there are many, many other Medicaid, Americans with Disabilities Act, private health insurance. There are just a myriad of obstacles that are placed in front of a person with a very severe disability.
Well, I can imagine that it's difficult in an urban setting, but when you get out into the bush, the problem just would multiply. But I thank you very much.
Thank you.
On that,
okay, on that point, Representative Guttenberg.
I got a constituent email about cuts to independent living, and I'm trying to.
Mr. Chairman, the commissioner gets to answer these kind of questions because I can tell you exactly how we got a, you got the question from your constituent. While I can't discuss the governor's proposed budget because Madam Frasca over at the big OMB in the sky across the street or down the street is working that up, and we actually had our first budget meeting with her shop. It was yesterday. What I can tell you that the administration gave clear instructions to the commissioners that were brought on board that there would be no sacred cows, to look at every program and evaluate on the basis of its service delivery to the citizens and to those constituencies to find out what these programs do. So in that regard, I, as commissioner, took a look at our budget, and to the chagrin of the acting director, I said, I need to know something about this program. I need to know how many people we serve, what are the services rendered. I didn't ask him the question that Representative Lynn asked, what would be the optimum size of this particular service, but we are trying to learn about the need for various programs in our budget, and that's one we're very concerned about because we have questions about it. In the course of me making that request with the idea that we would look for some cuts in that particular program, we requested some information from my acting director shop, and he in turn requested information from the person that was administering that program. Unfortunately, for both the person that was in administering that program and the Independent Living Council and the public and certainly the clients that are served by this and affected by it, I think that they were given a false alarm in terms of their concern, because no cut has been made. The budget has not been prepared, and you certainly haven't seen it. And I know your constituents are concerned. I probably have, I'm up to about 436 emails, I think, on my particular machine. And all I can tell you is that we in state government will look at every program, evaluate its efficient delivery, and that you all get to make the determination and the finality what gets funded and what doesn't. So we're certainly concerned about that. And I'm learning more and more about this particular program than I did before we actually asked for that information.
Well, I hope when you, look at and evaluate the cost of the situation of independent living, that you also evaluate the cost to society for the rest of us for cutting back in those departments, for the ability to provide meaningful life and employment for people that in need of those facilities. And not having those facilities results in what I consider a greater burden, greater financial cost for the rest of us.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond. In my discussions on the Hill the last couple of days, your old friend and colleague, Senator Robin Taylor, and retired Senator Mike Miller actually did some yeoman work on helping to set up the general fund portion of this program. And so, again, I was asking for information, and he explained to me the ratio of cost savings that are saved to the state Medicaid program by this particular program. So, again, I think we are learning a lot about the functions of the department. We will evaluate and continue to evaluate programs. And just let me say something, because I have observed the legislative process for years, and I think some of you believe, as I do, that we can continue to nibble at this budget to the point where some programs are not effective. And I think at some point you have to make a decision. They're hard decisions to make, because every program that the legislature has funded and created and administration has administered has a constituency. We must be responsible when we look at those and make sure that whatever cuts come to get your arms around the size of this government, that we do it in a kind, in a respectful manner, with the idea that it's the dollars that are paid into these programs that must deliver the optimum service for the dollars that are being invested. And we will pay attention to that, sir, I assure you.
Representatives Roper, then Crawford, then Dahlberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to direct a number of statements more than any questions right now. There's a number of things on my mind that I'd like to bring to the attention of the committee and the commissioner. I understand, Mr. Chairman, that the commissioner is going to be back again on Monday.
That's correct.
Not that I expect answers on these. I just wanted to give you a heads up on certain issues that are really important to me, and I think may be important to other members of the committee. And in the interest of time, I'll just go through them pretty rapidly and just invite your comments if you care to comment. I don't expect you to answer. I'm sure you may want to answer on a couple of them, but I guess number one is that the legislature did in the past provide additional funding for boiler and pressure vessel inspectors, and because we had a 6,000 boiler backlog, and it was a matter of public safety. So we stepped up to the plate and did provide some additional funding. There's some controversy about it, so I'd like to get some idea how that's working out. I hope you're not writing regulations on it. Secondly, I just want to inform you we have, before the legislature, we will have a building code war. We have three different departments that have jurisdiction over mechanical contracting statutes and the building codes. Your department has a predominant role in that. But we find ourselves, particularly in the mechanical code right now, where there's a significant controversy within the industry. We have occupational licensing, the Department of Community and Economic Development have jurisdiction. We have the Department of Public Safety with certain jurisdictions. We have your department's jurisdiction. We endeavored to get some legislation to clarify that last year. I think it's going to be controversial. It should come forward. I'd like to see this entire area cleared up and cleaned up, so because it does affect the businesses and organized labor and the development of the state. So I think we need to get this issue cleaned up and cleared up and move forward. And I am concerned about this overlap, and I'd like to see some clarification. But thirdly, I think an important thing is that the prevailing wage enforcement, otherwise known as Little Davis-Bacon, I think there is correspondence received from a number of areas in the state, and more specifically a letter comes to mind that received in the last quarter from AVAC, Ms. Mira Kohler, which is a rural electrification group that because of PC and other state funds to these basically private entities, that there was, I believe, some regulations were promulgated in the last administration which has forced these private entities to implement prevailing wage situations where, particularly in the rural areas, where they want to be able to hire local people, put the local workforce to work, but because of this new regulation and they've got their hands tied, they've had to pay prevailing wages to hire skilled people. They can't even hire the local folks to work on local projects. I mean, something's really out of kilter here. And there's another area I noticed that there's been expansion of this type of prevailing wage issue through our statute into other procurement areas. For example, the legislature went out for office space in Anchorage last year, and all of a sudden there's prevailing wage stuff for the forcing private sector landlords to use prevailing wage contractors for tenant improvement fit up on bid jobs. I mean, to me, that's outrageous. I mean, you know, that's the tentacles of state government telling the private sector what to do. So, I mean, this whole thing, I'd like, if you could give the committee a report, you might want to talk to the chairman about this. Get back to us and see if the last, what regulations were promulgated in your department, specifically on the prevailing wage issue, but perhaps any other regulations, kind of going out the door stuff that might happen. We'd like to know what the department did the last year. And then moving on to another area of interest is the, I believe this committee passed an adjustment in the unemployment insurance compensation, but somebody can refresh me. I don't think it got through the whole legislature.
It did not. It languished and actually it died.
I'm kind of curious about, you know, what your role is, you propose to do. You might want to talk about that later. And interested in that is a controversial thing, and kind of reminds me of the workers' comp situation, where there's some arguments that say that we haven't made those adjustments. But I guess you should be made aware of that. One of my big pet peeves is the STEP program and the phantom tax that's imposed on small businesses of the state. And I'm going to make a couple comments. I want Harry, I don't want you to get your blood pressure up here now, but I just wanted to put you on notice that. And I'm a small businessman. I pay this tax, but I'm not sure most small business people know that they're paying this tax. And this money has gone into the STEP program to provide our workforce development programs. And I have tried to bird dog the department for a number of years, and I think there's been some reforms and progress. But quite frankly, some of that money was, I think, misdirected and poorly used. And it really burns me. Matter of fact, and this is, here, now, don't get mad now, I support, like, organized labor's apprenticeship program. They have great programs. They do a wonderful thing. But I did take due note that here we have private sector business people basically subsidizing organized labor's apprenticeship programs through this STEP program. Now, I think maybe some of that's appropriate, but there's other competing elements. There's a group, the ABC group has non-union apprenticeship programs. They had received no money. There's an equity issue here. There's smacks of politics. You know, the main job, and I think everybody here at this table and your department agree, particularly on retraining workers and so forth, we need to do the best job we can for the people of the state of Alaska. We don't need to color decisions of allocation based on political philosophies. And I think there's been a tendency to do that. See, this irony of it is, to me, is the small business people and the business people of the state, along with everybody else, pays this tax, don't even know they're paying it, and the government's redirecting it and using it for their purposes. So, and I think even in, was it Senate Bill 40, we even increased the sucker. Man, ooh. Anyway, but it's not, you know, I'm not denigrating any particular program. What I'm concerned about is how those are allocated and should not be based on any political considerations or anything of that nature. That's all I ask. I think we should be very aware of that. And the people, and you got to tell people they're paying a tax they don't even know they're paying.
Commissioner, if you want to address those at the confirmation hearing or now.
I just want to make one short comment, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Sure.
And I will bring additional information, but Representative Rookberg, through the chair, when we came into our jobs, the Department of Labor had an image problem with the public, and that was one of them you talked about, that the department was accused of favoring certain parts of industry or labor over others. I can tell you without fear of contradiction, we will not do that, sir. Our governor has made it very clear that we are to depoliticize the agency. We are to do what's right for the workers and the employers of the state. and we will not be, we will not put our finger on the scale for either union or non-union. We will treat everybody fairly. Is that right, Mr. Fisher?
That's correct.
And I will be back with other answers next week.
Thanks. Okay, follow up.
And I didn't even open up the whole area of wage an hour and other worker training stuff that we get into later.
We'll see you again, I'm sure.
Okay, Representative Crawford and then Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, actually, my blood pressure is fine.
Representative Roker didn't hear that from our union brother.
No, that's good. That's good. Eric had some events, but that's good. I hope he understands what I'm getting.
But I did want a little bit more on the unemployment insurance question. Last year, we in the House did pass a bill, but it died in the Senate. I'm wanting to know if you were going to bring that bill forward again, if it was going to be at the same rate that we used last year. I know that the information that we got last year is that the state of Alaska does the worst job in the nation of replacing the average weekly wage when our workers get laid off. And due to the cyclical nature of our economy up here, unemployment insurance is certainly more important than most in any other state in the nation. And we keep losing our skilled workforce to the lower 48 because they don't have enough to make it through the winter many times. With the benefits that we pay here, they go to San Francisco or to Seattle, and they don't come back. So I was just wondering what was going to happen on the unemployment insurance.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crawford, we have not received certainly the policy from the government with the governor with respect to legislation that he will introduce to my request. We have not got to that point in the discussion, but I can tell you this. Having followed that bill, and now apparently we are at number 50 or 49 or 50, and we're looking up at Alabama in terms of our weekly benefit, I can tell you every dollar that we can put back into this economy in Alaska is going to be rolled over, in most cases, 1.7 to 1.9 times. If we do anything with respect to this benefit, we must address this problem because it's unconscionable that we didn't get this done. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do as commissioner. I am going to meet with those folks that objected to the passage of that bill and visit with them and see if there's some accommodation we can make that makes this work for both labor and industry. And certainly the economy is our target. Our governor's made it very clear that it's the economy, folks, and that's what we're going to do. And this, to us, is an economic initiative, not just necessarily a replacement of weekly wage. It is it has something to do with increasing and improving the economy, and that's where I believe we're going. So I certainly will report back to you as soon as I get information on there. But, you know, you all are empowered to introduce legislation as well.
Why don't we wrap it up with Representative Dahlstrom because of the meeting with the governor at 5. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. The first is for Commissioner O'Clery. I've received some constituent concern about the Access Alaska program. Is that one of the programs that's being considered?
That is, Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair. That has to do with the independent living side of it, and yes, you'll get more from us on that.
Okay.
So that's what that's all about.
And the second question is for Mr. Grossi with the Workers' Compensation Board. You mentioned there's a board review of eligibility for retraining. I'm interested in knowing what the requirements are to be qualified to serve on that board and if there are medical professionals on that board and how many.
Mr. Grossi.
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair. For reemployment, it is those determinations are made by the Reemployment Benefits Administrator. Those aren't made by the board. However, the board does have review of those decisions if either side, the employer or the employee, feel that decision was made incorrectly. And that is the Workers' Compensation Board. The Workers' Compensation Board is a board that is made up in statute of the Commissioner of Labor or his designee
there's panels, and there is a labor member and an industry seat member, and those are the people that sit on it. There isn't a medical professional sitting on the board itself. However, the board always has medical expert in the way of testimony and medical reports and that type of information that that they review when they're making their decisions. So, and there's also a an opportunity for the board to have their own examinations performed by doctors that are on a list of doctors that are have been found not to be biased either for the employee or the employer, and those are chosen by panels of attorneys actually that represent each side.
Can I ask one more question, Mr. Chairman? Is this the same board who makes the decisions on those that are qualified for retraining?
No. As far as the retraining program, that decision is made by the Rehabilitation Benefits Administrator, Representative Dahlstrom. And the board would only make the decision on the, you know, if either side feels that that is improper, then they would review that administrator's decision. So yes and no, I guess, is the answer to that question.
That's a terrible way to answer a question.
Well, Commissioner, I just want to thank you and your staff. It's easy for us as legislators to say, hey, come over here tomorrow, the next day, but your report, I think, is assiduous and detailed, and we appreciate you all coming. There's five freshmen here, of course, veteran Representative Crawford and Rokeberg, but this is our first committee hearing, so we're honored to have heard you and have you come before us, and we look forward to a hint, smooth transition on Monday and a good hearing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. 17 grandchildren you met?
Wow.
And one great-grandchild that will be here in March.
Wow. Okay, well.
That's why I look like I do.
The House Labor and Commerce Committee adjourns at 4:33.
Thank you.